You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, keep listening if you dare. We talk with Wisconsin's own paranormal researcher, Chad Lewis, about supernatural dares of the Midwest. Now, if you've ever seen a black cat and decided to go the other way, you were part of a superstition that goes back a long time. You most likely know that black cats are often recognized as a symbol of bad luck during Halloween, often associated with witches. But where does that come from? Simon Bronner is the Dean of the College of General Studies and Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. He's the author of the Encyclopedia of American Folklife. Simon, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
How far back does superstition about cats, and I guess black cats in particular, really go?
We know that it shows up in Greek mythology, certainly, with the figure of Hecate, who was shown as the goddess of magic and sorcery, and she often had a pet of a black cat, and that was not only in oral tradition, but in visual culture as well.
Now, how about medieval Europe? That's when, I guess, if I thought, okay, our modern superstition goes back that far, it's probably something in Christian medieval Europe. What kind of things do we see there?
Well, Christianity has a lot to do with it, particularly in Europe, in the transition from paganism to Christianity. And the Catholic Church was trying to separate itself from the animism of the time. So there's actually a declaration that we have by Pope Gregory in 1233 with a whole bestiary that was connected with evil. And one of the biggest culprits was black cat, because that was supposed to be the incarnation of the devil.
I have had a black cat who, you know, would pounce on my feet while I was sleeping. I didn't think it was associated with the devil or anything. What is it about cats in particular, you think, that put them on that bestiary of evil?
Well, there are a lot of theories about that. Feminists would argue the association of black cats with witches and with older women was one of the signs that they were independent and marginalized and not in the family norm, and therefore they were often accused of witchcraft with this associated cat that was there, certainly. Another aspect is just that the connection with the night and the contrast of the day, which is supposed to be good, and the night, and the association with forests and the nocturnal and the supernatural as a result of that.
And I understand cats got a really bad rap during the era of the Black Plague.
Yes, there was the mistaken belief that they were spreading the bubonic plague, partly because they were independent and would roam around. So it was one of the theories there, and black cats were burned ceremoniously and killed, even though that doing that actually helped spread the bubonic plague, because it was the rats that were actually the carriers. But the rats were not as visible, and the black cats were.
Now, in the modern day, I think mostly the suspicion about black cats has gone away, but we still kind of, in our fun celebrations of Halloween, carry on that tradition of the black cat in the imagery. Can you talk about how that may have been, I guess, tamed over the centuries?
Well, sure. You should know that there's an American connection, because the Puritans were especially hostile to black cats, carrying on this idea of the reincarnation of the devil and also the association with witches. But in the late 19th century, postcards came in, greeting cards came in, and lithographs. And one of the ways to depict Halloween as a fun kind of celebration and not just a time when all the evil spirits are released is to show the black cats, often with orange caps and often with yellow or green eyes, which was another aspect, even though that's relatively rare among cats. And that continued on with the celebration of candies as well, and the use of cats at that time. But I should point out that some of that has arguably been in decline with the rise of spiders, partly because cats have a more positive image today than they probably did previously. Maybe all those cat memes have something to do with it.
And you also mentioned the Halloween candy. And yeah, I have an arsenal of candy at home that I'm hoping to hand out tonight and not eat quite so much of. How did candy end up being such a central part of Halloween?
Well, trick-or-treating was not all about the getting of sweets. And there's an argument that municipalities and communities wanted to get away from the trick, the mischief, the pranks that would often be occurring and have a different way to tame it down. And this idea of actually trying to bribe children by giving them candy started to come into vogue. And there has been an argument that the candy companies, which were not having an easy time because candies were perishable, of selling them, and they encouraged and promoted the use of the candies as the treat that would be given out at Halloween time.
Simon, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have a happy Halloween.
You too. That's Simon Bronner, Dean of the College of General Studies and Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He joins us today for a look at some Halloween folklore, including the symbolism behind black cats. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a spooky story for Halloween.
If you ask around, you'll likely hear that ghosts are lurking on UW-Madison's historic campus, from things like the very real graves atop Bascom Hill to generations of student lore. Many have reported that the history here sometimes goes bump in the night. WPR's A. Emily Ralph explores the intersection of history and rumor in one of the university's oldest buildings.
11:55. Enough time for one more story. One more story before 12. Just to keep us warm.
Okay, so rumor has it on campus that Science Hall was the medical building and the doctors and med students would work on cadavers, but the morgue was in the basement and a lot of the laboratories were upstairs. Before they had elevators, they used to transport cadavers up and down through dumbwaiters in the walls. Rumor has it that they lost a couple bodies. The other thing that I heard was that there was a mad professor whose office was kind of in the attic, and he did crazy experiments up there, and everything is still set up to this day with the labels on the drawers and beakers. This drawer's for fingers, that drawer's for toes, and everything's just very creepy. But that's a fun myth that people like to tell about Science Hall.
That's Brittany Williams, UW grad and former director of engineering at WPR, recorded back when she was a student. The best ghost stories are the ones where so much of them is true. I don't know about the mad professor, but the rest is dead on. As recently as the 1970s, students were still finding human remains around the building. Over the years, people have reported feeling a presence or suddenly smelling strong odors of blood or formaldehyde. Ghost or not, Science Hall is an imposing building, standing like a Gothic red brick fortress guarding the heart of campus. The old anatomy labs were on the fourth floor, and that's supposed to be the most haunted part of the building. It's definitely creepy, but I'm more interested in rumors of secret labs and mad scientists in the attic. Building manager Jim Miller gave me and a few grad students the tour.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Marion.
At first glance, it looks like any other big old attic. Dusty, full of boxes, and a floor where a misstep could be pretty bad. Then we turn a corner and things get weird. The place is kind of set up like a lab, with the remains of sinks or workstations maybe. A cabinet full of missing drawers still has some labels on it.
Yeah, it says meat slicer extras. That's what I bet I'm
thinking. It gets better, though. In the room off that, shelves have big labels indicating where to keep your chemicals and...
Head holders.
Head holders? I don't know what a head holder is, but I'm hoping the meat slicer extras aren't involved. As cool as all this is, there's another dimension here, and that's up.
It's got a letter to my mom in it.
Okay, well, make sure she gets it if something happens.
We climb a series of ladders and platforms all the way to the peak of the building's top tower. The floor is about the size of a picnic table, and here we find one last mystery. Two chairs, a deck of cards, and a can of Skull. At least the ghosts obey the no smoking policy. They have an amazing view, too. Metal vents in the roof slide open, and the whole city stretches out before you. I didn't see anything supernatural, but I wanted to. I keep my eyes open in the dark. Maybe one day I'll meet the ghost with a taste for heights and chewing tobacco.
WPR's senior spooky correspondent, A. Emily Ralph, with a story on UW-Madison's Science Hall. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a Wisconsin paranormal researcher tells us where some of the freakiest dares around the state are and what happens when you complete them. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, what if I said Bloody Mary three times fast? Well, nothing. I'm not in front of a mirror, so that doesn't count. I'm not in front of a bartender, so I won't get three drinks. Repeating something three times, though, is often part of the ritual of completing a supernatural dare, according to our next guest, and he'd know. He's done a lot of them. Eau Claire's own Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher and legend tripper. He's the author of more than 25 books on the supernatural, including one of his most recent called Supernatural Dares of the Midwest, Curses, Monsters, and Ghosts. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy Halloween to you.
And to you, Chad. Great to talk to you on Halloween, of all days in particular. Now, that Bloody Mary thing I mentioned, like, a lot of school kids, anyway, have heard of this. You say Bloody Mary three times, mirror, dark, ghost appears. You write about a lot of location-specific dares. Why are there so many of these things out there?
People are itching for the unique and bizarre, that they want to get away from the same restaurants, hotels, businesses that they see, and they want to go out, and believe it or not, they want to get scared. Being scared is fun when it's in a controlled manner. Like going to a scary movie or riding a roller coaster, you know, you're probably going to survive, but there's that iffy part as well.
And you, as always, are seeking out local legends. And when you go to a community with some of the specific dares, this is something that a lot of people know about, right? They know if you go to this place and do this thing, do X, Y is going to happen. These are part of local folklore.
These places really have become a rite of passage. So many people tell me that when they were in high school, the thing to do was just to go out to the legend area and complete the dare. Try to test your bravery. See if you can sit on a mausoleum or cursed chair longer than your friend. So it was really something passed from generation to generation that everybody in the community knew about and participated in.
Let's check out some of the specific ones. Now, this is interesting. I was flipping through, of course, looking for the Wisconsin ones in particular. Three of them happen on bridges. The Bloody Bride Bridge in Stevens Point, Blood-Soaked Bridge in Lowell, and Weary Road in Evansville. What's the deal with bridges in Wisconsin, Chad?
Great point. I could have done an entire book on bridge dares. But many people believe that much like bridges in our world connect water with land, they hold a power in the spirit world, a significance of connecting our world with the spirit world. And plus, water plays a big part into folklore. It's where a lot of our ancestors came over and lived by the water. So their stories came with them, the non-indigenous ones. So water and bridges combined seem to make a perfect area for weird things to happen.
Okay, so let's go to Stevens Point and the Bloody Bride Bridge. What is the dare? What is the story around it?
Story is, many years ago, a young woman died on her wedding night coming home. She bled to death waiting for help to arrive. And now unsuspecting motorists have seen this woman walking on the bridge, often appearing like maybe she needs help or broke down, needs some assistance. But when people slow down, she simply either vanishes into thin air or is not there at all. But the dare is that if you're brave enough or foolish enough to park your car on the bridge, when you look into your back mirror, not only will you see the ghost of this bloody bride, but many witnesses told me that she'll actually be sitting right in your back seat while you're parked there.
Okay, now this is bringing back a Twilight Zone memory of an episode I saw too early, but I'll power through. You are both brave and foolhardy, Chad. You did this and most of the other dares in your book, right?
I'm self-proclaiming myself as the Guinness World Record holder for doing the most supernatural dares. I've done hundreds of them. So I'm at the point, Rob, now that if anything bad, mishap, misfortune, or death happens to me, I wouldn't know what dare to blame it on.
And that's another thing. Some of these dares aren't like, if you do this, something bad is going to happen while you do it. Some of them are, you know, the spirit will appear or whatever. Some of them are, if you do it, misfortune will come to you at some point in the near future, right?
99% of these dares around the world are negative. It's hardly ever anything. If you do the dare, you're going to find true love or win the lottery. It's always you'll be in a car accident, lose your job, break up with your significant others, all kinds of just terrible ill fate and harbingers of bad, ill future for you. So I always encourage people, do these at your own risk.
Talking to Chad Lewis, one of his most recent books is Supernatural Dares of the Midwest, Curses, Monsters, and Ghosts. Yeah, and this is something, I think of this as mainly a teenage sort of thing to do, and everybody's egging each other on, and, oh, are you chicken, whatever. I think, though, you did encounter one, a mausoleum-related dare where a 70-year-old woman told you she gave it a shot.
Yes, you'd be mistaken thinking this is just teenagers. A woman was 70 years old sitting up on a haunted mausoleum where the legend is you'll be shoved to the ground, which is over 6.5 feet up. So she was taking the dare, and luckily for us anyway, she was not pushed. But I had a woman outside of Madison in Evansville go to Weary Road and claim that she saw this giant, big wolf-like creature with glowing yellow eyes as she parked on the bridge and felt this thing was going to harm her. So we often think of it being high school age or college age kids going out there with their imagination. But often it runs the entire spectrum of curious people.
And you hit the books and the vintage newspapers to try to track down, you know, did these legends happen or what were some of the earliest reports of them? Can you talk a little bit about the historical research you do?
Like all good legends, many of the origins are unknown. Sometimes the decade is not even known. There's a goat man that is said to roam Marsh Road outside of New London, dating back to at least the 1950s, probably earlier, but there's no real account of it. So sometimes that's very difficult when you're trying to sort fact from fiction and trying to find, is there an origin story to this? And sometimes there is, but it may be embellished or just been wrongly placed over the years. Sometimes you'll talk to seniors in an area. They'll tell you one version of a legend. You talk to high schoolers, they have a completely different version, as though over the decades, the folklore has played a game of telephone.
You took up every dare in the book except one, a bonus one you give at the end, but not for lack of trying. Can you talk about the mysterious book that will kill you in Whitewater, Wisconsin?
So the Whitewater Library, in some versions it's the public, others it's the university, has a book under lock and key that if you check this book out, it's a book of the dead. You will die either by a tragic accident or your own hand. And I joke that I don't know who keeps returning the book, but that's the legend. And every year the librarians tell me, don't talk about this. We don't have the book. Don't send people here, which is exactly what you would expect those sneaky librarians to tell you. So I've spoken at both the Whitewater Public and University Library, and I love bringing it up to the librarians because they think it's a fun story. And even the local university paper said that over a dozen faculty and staff have died from checking this out with students as well, and that you'll be expelled if you even try to check it out, which you will not. So I always just tell people, go there. Just make sure you have someone set up to return it when you meet your fate.
Excellent. And Chad, some dares are timing specific. Are there any good Halloween day or Halloween night ones?
Yes, especially as the goat man I mentioned, because it's also on Marsh Road that it is thought to be haunted by some homecoming royalty, a king and queen who took their own lives out there many years ago. And it was during homecoming week, the week of Halloween. So if you go out there, it is said you're more likely to experience it tonight than any other day of the year.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks as always for joining us today.
Keep an eye out.
Eau Claire's own Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher and legend tripper. We talked to them today about one of his latest books, Supernatural Dares of the Midwest, Curses, Monsters, and Ghosts, as we mark Halloween. Chad has several free speaking engagements coming up in Wisconsin. He'll talk about winter legends and lore this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at the Sun Prairie Public Library, Thursday at 6:30 at the Delafield Public Library. Hey, if you have a local legend of a dare or other supernatural nature to share, let us know about it. We can pass along to Chad. He's probably heard about it, but maybe not. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did you do one of these as a teenager or a 70-year-old? Email ideas@WPR.org and let us know. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, inflation is still kind of high. Unemployment is still pretty low. So how is the economy doing? We're going to check in on the state of the U.S. economy and what it means for you, and you can call in and tell us how it's going for you. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The United States ranks behind dozens of other countries in literacy. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, 1 in 6 American adults has low literacy skills. In Wisconsin, that number is lower than the national average, with 7% at a low literacy level. There's a lot that goes into the problem, and our next guest says a big part of the solution can happen long before kids even start school. In her new book, she shares advice to help get kids ready for reading starting at age 0. We're listening back to our conversation with her now, and you could let us know your reading story by emailing ideas@WPR.org. What do you remember about learning how to read? Looking back, are there things you think were missing from your reading education? If you have kids, how have you helped them learn to read? What's worked? What hasn't? And if you teach young students, love to hear your story and what you think. Email ideas@WPR.org. Maya Payne Smart is a Milwaukee-based literacy advocate and affiliated faculty in educational policy and leadership in the College of Education at Marquette University. Her new book is called Reading for Our Lives, a Literacy Action Plan from Birth to 6. We talked with her this summer. To start with, you're kind of sounding the alarm on the importance of starting on literacy way before school starts. Tell us why that's so important.
It's so important for parents and educators and everyone really in our community to start thinking about reading with infants and toddlers, because so much brain development happens in those early years. And so much of the groundwork that supports future reading success happens long before kids can make sense of text on a page.
How much difference does it make for that kid? Say they're just hitting kindergarten. How much difference does it make to have a background in some of this pre-literacy learning that they might get from their parents or from a child care center?
It makes a huge difference. There are numerous studies that document a positive correlation between things like the number of letter names that a child knows at kindergarten entry and their reading ability down the road, because all of these skills kind of build on one another. And so the vocabulary that parents can introduce first orally, language development supports literacy development down the road. But all of those words that parents are speaking to kids, whether reading a book or just engaging in conversation in everyday life, contributes to the words that they'll be able to recognize and print down the road. And then there are so many other skills, the ability to discern sounds within words or the ability to recognize different letter shapes. All of those things contribute to reading down the road. And so it's important for parents to have an understanding of how it unfolds over time.
we'll dig into a lot of the practical advice you give in the book. One more point I want to get to before we do that is, yeah, it's been a day or two since my kids were that little, but I remember, you know, when I'd read to them, I'd like, great, this is the magic ingredient. Reading to them is going to do it. Reading your book, reading to kids is great, but we need a little more. Why isn't just reading to them going to do the job?
I think many parents are in the same boat that you were in, where you think of the book as this magical device and also this magical experience with your child. So it's just important to remember that it's really about you and the child and the relationship and that dynamic exchange back and forth with them. So the book is important to the extent that it prompts conversation and to the extent that they're paying attention to some of the print on the page. But the magic is really in that relationship. And so I, in the book, devote two chapters actually to the power of conversation and talk, just to really emphasize that point to parents, that it's not just about the words that we're saying, whether we're speaking aloud or narrating what we're doing during the day. It's about that turn taking, the back and forth, serve and return duet of conversation with the child. And when we ask questions, it gives them a chance to formulate responses and, again, build those brain connections that are so important down the road.
Talking to Maya Payne Smart about her new book. It's called Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, where there are things you did to encourage literacy, maybe for your own kids in that preschool era. Do you have questions for our guest? Are you a new parent? Maybe you need some advice. I know I did. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. And Maya, yeah, when I saw age, you know, from birth to six, I thought, well, wait, how can kids be reading at birth? Well, they can't. But you were just talking about that idea of modeling conversation, a back and forth between a parent and a kid before that kid can even talk. Could you spell out how that works?
Absolutely. So it's important for parents to recognize all of the attempts at communication that their infant is making. So while your three-month-old isn't going to respond in words or sentences, they will give you coos and babbles that indicate their engagement and indicate their learning. So if we treat those babbles as conversation or respond to those and ask questions and just proceed as if it's a typical conversation with words, we're creating so many wonderful learning opportunities for that child. And I think it's also important for parents to recognize that when the littlest babies are slapping at the book or chewing it, throwing it, all of that is important exposure to books, but also important sensory learning for the child. So don't discount that.
And speaking of those books, you know, me reading to a kid, great. Letting the kid interact, you say, is really the key. Talk about ways we can do that starting at an early age.
Kids are learning when they're interested in paying attention and engaged. So hearing the story, they're going to pick up wonderful vocabulary and knowledge and background information. When they're older, let's say three or four, and they start to pay attention to the print, and you're dragging your finger from left to right, that's teaching them something about print, or you're showing that the text moves from left to right or top to bottom of the page. There are just so many lessons within the book objects. But again, the parent brings the lesson alive by paying attention to the child, noticing what they're interested in, and responding with words and gestures.
And so it can be things like point at the dog or help me turn the page or whatever is age appropriate, right?
Absolutely. And the age appropriate piece is so important because there's so much growth and development that happens from birth, which is why I started the book mentioning from birth all the way to 6 years, because learning does look different at different ages. That 12 to 14 month old may be pointing to familiar characters or objects in the book, or they might point to things that they want you to name. They may be beginning to hold a crayon and make marks, the beginning of writing. So when parents have a little more knowledge about what's going on developmentally with children, they're better able to help the child get to the next level. And to your point earlier, we're not advocating that babies can read, but we are saying that parents can nurture future reading through this type of engagement.
One big theme in your book, I think parents might hear this and think, oh my God, I'm already trying to feed my kids and make sure their sheets are clean and whatever, and, you know, and have a job and things like that. I can't do hour long reading lessons every day too. A lot of the stuff, so much of the stuff you're talking about is stuff we can work in to our daily routines, right?
Yes. And there are so many opportunities in the day to build these things in. when the child is waking up or at a mealtime or bedtime or bath time or any of those routine moments, all of those everyday occurrences can be reminders to engage around language. One of my favorite examples is, I talk in the book about phonemic awareness, which is building awareness of the sounds within words. And I talk about how to do that with nursery rhymes and songs and wordplay and different things. And one parent, as a reminder to sing nursery rhymes, got a changing pad for their diaper changing station that had nursery rhyme imagery printed on it. And so it was just couldn't be a more timely reminder. So we often think of reminders on our calendars and clocks and things like that, but those physical reminders in the space where you're engaging in something with your child every day anyway are great opportunities to teach in a fun, playful way.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask Hello. About, Susan?
Hi. I'm a grandparent of a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old toddlers, and my daughter is career-minded, and her husband is too. They got busy lives. I want to support them. I want to help the grandkids out learning literacy and that. I can buy them books. I can buy them gifts for reading and that, but it may sit there. Do you have any tips on grandparents, how they can support this lifestyle?
Grandparents. Absolutely. Grandparents are so critical. Both of my daughter's grandmothers have played a major role in her literacy development. Even to this day, she's now entering fifth grade and is in a book club with one of her grandmothers. So grandparents, we encourage you to get involved as much as you can. But you can teach vocabulary as well, just in your conversations with the little ones and labeling and pointing and asking questions and being sure to keep the conversation going and giving them opportunities to respond, and all of that grandparents can do. And you can also teach some of these lessons. You mentioned your grandchildren were 3 to 4 years old. That's prime time to start bringing their attention to print. Many parents don't realize that often when you're reading picture books with kids, they think the story comes from the pictures. They're not always aware that the story lies in those black marks on the page. But even without a book in hand, if there's a stop sign or words on a graphic t-shirt, whatever print is in their environment, you can teach little lessons by just describing that those letters are all made of lines, dots, and curves, and saying, oh, look at that A, it's made with 3 lines, 2 long ones that go this way and this way, and you know, trace the short one in the middle. But that talking about letters and print, naming them, getting them to pay attention to those shapes, all of that really contributes.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, with advice on building literacy skills for kids even before they go to school. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember learning to read? Were there key things that you think helped you along the way or that you had trouble with along the way as a parent or grandparent? How have you worked to try to help your kids get ready to learn to read? Or do you have questions for our guest on how to do this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with literacy advocate Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to 6. You can join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, I have been sending colorful cards to my 4-year-old niece ever since she was little. I write a detailed message. She has kept all of those cards, and she'll take them out, and she will read stories. She'll make up stories about what I've said, or she'll look at the colors of the cards or the animals, and she will just talk about what's going on in the card. And that has really kept us connected with each other. And I think it's made her very articulate.
I love it, Christina. Thank you so much. Maya, that fits into a lot of things you talk about in your book, including community, connection with other people as being something that helps develop literacy.
Absolutely. Parents are stressed and starved for time and dealing with a lot of different things. So when you recognize that you don't have to do it all on your own, that you can rely on your network, your relatives, your neighbors and friends, librarians, pediatricians, and this bigger and bigger universe of people who are all supporting your child as a reader, it makes things easier. But connection, communication, all of those things that engage the child and get them interested in print and reading and writing, it's all wonderful.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Your guest has spoken of talking with a child or reading to a child, but I wonder, where does someone or a family comes from a culture of an oral tradition of telling stories? Where does that fit in?
Well, interesting. Tom, thanks. Maya, any thoughts on that?
Yes, an excellent question. And oral storytelling and those rich family and cultural traditions are so wonderful, and they also contribute to reading success. We just have to be clear on the contribution they make. So obviously they make contributions to that child's vocabulary and their cognitive skills, critical thinking, social connection. But what they're not going to get from oral storytelling is that familiarity with print. So they're not going to learn that text moves from left to right and top to bottom of the page. They aren't going to gain familiarity with recognizing the letters in print. So continue with the storytelling, absolutely, and know that it has value and is wonderful and contributes to their ability to understand what they read down the road, and also just to have all of this rich vocabulary and background knowledge to build upon. But know that they also need print awareness, which can come from books or, as I mentioned earlier, text that appears on cereal boxes or T-shirts or in other contexts.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Maya Smart about her book, Reading for Our Lives, A Literacy Action Plan from Birth to Six. Maya, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get your advice for, say there's somebody out there listening, they're a parent, and they're thinking, hey, I never developed good literacy skills myself. I'm not a strong reader, maybe even a little intimidated by it. Do you have advice for them on how to help their kids out anyway?
The main advice is to play to your strengths and be confident in knowing that the conversation that you have, listening to them, responding to their coos and babbles and other communication as they get older, all of that is valuable and supports reading and literacy as well. And then even when it comes to teaching specific literacy skills or building their awareness of letters and print, most parents, even if they aren't tremendous readers themselves, know more letters than that three-year-old or that four-year-old. So you can lean into what you do know and be sure to share that. And then you can also look to your community and support, maybe story time through librarians for them to get even more exposure to language and opportunities to get familiar with books. And talking to your pediatrician about those developmental milestones and how they're tracking and where they're going and where there might be opportunities to bring in specialists or other support. So definitely do what you can, do it with confidence, do it with joy, make it playful, songs, games, all of that is wonderful.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Juanita is with us in Fitchburg. Juanita, hi.
Go back to our callers at 800.
I'm hearing Juanita's radio. I guess Juanita wanted to mention using music to help words come to life. That sounds great. Let's go to Susie now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I was going to mention when my kids were little, we used to play the alphabet game while we were in the car. Whether we were in the, you know, out in the country or in the city, they had to find the letters of the alphabet. We wanted to see, especially in town, how fast we could go through the whole alphabet. So they had to look at the signs outside and find A and then B and then C and then, you know, through all the way, obviously, all the way through. Also just reminding them that, you know, we read for a lot of reasons, not just in books, you know.
Great. Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, I think the story is I learned my first letter was a letter K because to drive anywhere from where I was, you had to go by the Kmart. And there is a big
yes.
K. But Susie, that's a great example, Maya, of the kind of things we could do, again, without even cracking a book open.
Absolutely. Those everyday opportunities that are fun and enjoyable. So if it's a game, don't think that it's not teaching or that they aren't learning, because they absolutely are. And the more fun and engaging it is, the more time they're going to spend on task building that letter knowledge in that case. But songs, all of that is wonderful. I met someone over the weekend whose son was deemed the king of kindergarten at his school because of his strong reading when he entered school. And the mom explained that he learned it because they had a karaoke business. And he spent a lot of time watching people sing while seeing the text that they were singing, each word light up as they sang it. And so it wasn't with a book in hand, but it was still making that print sounds connection.
Excellent. Thanks for that call. I learned the rest of the alphabet, by the way, from baseball cards, the numbers too. Back to your calls now. Barb is with us in Winneconne. Barb, hello.
Hello. I'm a retired reading specialist. It's been 20 years already since I've been out, but it brought a big smile to my face when I heard Maya talk about her advice, because it hasn't changed in 30 years. It's the same things that we've been telling parents for a long time. So I'm so happy that that's what the message still is. And as far as the grandparents, the biggest reason I probably became a voracious reader was my grandmother. My grandma always had a stack of books next to her chair, and she would read that stack of books. Every week, my aunt would go to the library and look for a new stack of books for her to read, and she was having trouble finding new mysteries that Grandma hadn't read yet. But it made a big impression on me because I saw Grandma read, but I also saw Grandma really enjoy that reading.
Gotcha. Barb, thanks for the call. Maya, the idea of modeling reading for our kids, do as I do, in addition to do as I say.
I think that's part of it. And I know my daughter learns a lot about how much we value reading from the amount of time that she sees her grandmothers and parents reading. But watching us read doesn't necessarily teach her anything. So that's why I wanted in the book to really break down those foundational skills so parents can teach with more intention in daily life. And as the caller mentioned, they are classics. Like, they're the things that it takes to become a reader are the same things that it took 30 years ago. Vocabulary, the sound awareness, print awareness, letter knowledge, making those letter sound connections. So those are all classics, and parents can benefit from just thinking about them and intentionally inserting those opportunities to teach them.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just 30 seconds or so left. Maya, can you leave us with maybe some resources for more, apart from your book, of course, where people can find more info?
Yes, I encourage parents to take a look at developmental milestones, particularly with the younger kids, so that you are tuned into how much they're growing and developing. And it just keeps in your mind this sense of progress and boosts your curiosity and interest and attention to what they're doing so that you can respond and keep conversation going and ask questions, label and point, and all of those things that we discussed earlier. You really are your child's first teacher, and you can become their best teacher when you become more intentional about it.
Maya, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Maya Payne Smart is a Milwaukee-based literacy advocate. We talked to her back in August about her book, Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six. You can still let us know about your experiences with reading education. What do you remember about learning to read? How have you handled reading maybe with your own kids? What's worked? What hasn't? If you're a teacher of younger students, what have you seen when it comes to reading skills? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.